Reader's Entertainment Radio, where variety is the spice of life.
Hello, and welcome to Reader's Entertainment Radio. I'm your host, Sheila English. And tonight we have a special treat, two guests for the price of one, co-authors to the Winston Churchill thrillers. Please welcome Michael and Patrick McMenamin. How are you, gentlemen?
Thanks for having us.
Well, I'm so glad that we were finally able to connect, and I've been looking forward to get to doing the show. Now, you're a father-son writing duo. You have three books in the series, and I have a feeling that there may be more in the works, but first allow me to read this quote that I found about your work. I think this will really pique our listeners' interest. It's how Les Roberts, past president of the Private Eye Writers of America, characterizes the series set in the early 1930s and featuring a fictional Winston Churchill as a major character in these action-adventure historical novels. The Winston Churchill thrillers explode from the page in an era of global economic hardship where freedom is falling from favor, enveloping the reader from the first words. They recreate a world where democracies are falling by the wayside, replaced by tyrants, where liberty itself is in peril, and where the world stands on the precipice of a decade which will produce the most deadly war in history, a world where one man, out of power, out of favor, and a lone voice in the political wilderness, will rise up by decade's end to save Western civilization, Winston Churchill. Now, I know that the first book in the series won numerous awards, and the second book has also done very well, but tonight we're going to talk about the third installment of the series, The Gemini Agenda. But before we do, let me get our listeners all settled in. For our listeners, this is a pre-recorded show, but please do feel free to send questions and comments over at the blog. So after the show, you can download the podcast or come on over to readersentertainment.com, where we'll have the blog up, and you can find some links and some more information. And then if you do have some questions or comments, we will make certain that the authors get that. And I know a lot of our listeners like to check the website out while you're listening to the podcast, and you can find out more about the series at www.winstonchurchillthrillers.com. Now, Michael, I want to start with you. Tell us a little bit more about the overall series, the concept and story arc.
Well, the concept is to talk about and tell adventure stories about the rise of Hitler in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, during the period Winston Churchill was out of power, 1929 to 1939, because it's during that era that democracies were on the decline and dictatorships, both of the right and left, were on the rise. And we like adventure stories, we like romance stories, and we wanted to tell stories like that against that backdrop.
So tell me, why Churchill?
Well, two reasons. One, you're supposed to write about what you know, and Patrick and I, myself especially, know a lot about Churchill. I've written about him for years. I've written a biography of him. But most people don't know this about Winston. They think of the guy, a fat guy with a cigar standing up against Hitler. But they don't realize that as a young man, Churchill was a very adventurous young man. He was a fencing champion in prep school, a championship polo player. He was a seaplane pilot in the early 1910s when it was dangerous to do so. He was a much decorated war hero in his 20s. He fought in Afghanistan. He fought in the Sudan. He fought in South Africa. In World War One, when other politicians, after he stepped down as First Lord of the Admiralty, when other politicians were sending young men to their deaths, Churchill was actually in the trenches as a battalion commander. So he's in many ways a perfect character to put into an adventure series.
And, you know, it's interesting. Since reading the books, it's really inspired me to learn a little bit more about him. I had no idea he was such a physical person. Like you said, you think about the pictures that you've seen, you know, where he's smoking a cigar, and I had no idea he was. He truly is a man of action.
He was a crack shot throughout his life, and frequently because he had lots of enemies. He had bodyguards around him from Scotland Yard when he was in office. He would frequently carry a weapon himself.
Wow. Now, I'm going to switch gears just a little bit. Tell me, what is it like to write a book with someone else?
Well, you know, I've done it both ways. Whenever you're writing a book by yourself, you're always bouncing it off of people anyway. You're sending it to your editor. Your editor's giving you comments. Writing a book with someone else, especially someone you're in tune with, like Patrick and I, it's like having an editor looking at every chapter and trading ideas back and forth. It's a very interesting process, and it's collaborative.
Tell me, what is it like for you to write a novel with your father?
About what you'd expect if you were to engage in something as large as writing a book with your own parents. The most awkward parts, I have to admit, are editing my own father's sex scenes. There's no end to the awkwardness of that. Yet, if you can get through that, you can get through anything, I imagine. No, it's a big mix of incredibly rewarding, but also equal parts frustrating. As you know, if you ever argue with your own parents and stuff, you continue arguing over the book instead. You've grown up, you're no longer arguing about things at home, but now we argue about the book instead. It's a really rewarding process that kind of has kept us close and in touch. And to the dismay of my family, our family, whenever we get together, we tend to monopolize each other at dinner table conversations and talk about the book. It's a really cool thing that we've been able to actually improve each other's writing in the process. And then we have these books to show for. So it's just really exciting to actually have that kind of achievement with your own father.
Yeah, you know, I could see that being kind of a double-edged sword. Like you said, you know, there would be some unique challenges to writing some of the book. But, you know, I talked to both of you, you know, a few times before, and you obviously are very close. You seem to be, you know, very good friends as well as, father and son. So I think that's got to be fun.
It goes back actually to growing up, my mom would have to be would work late one night of the week, and the two of us would have what we call boys' night out. This starting when I was like 12 or 13, I can't really remember, but where we would eat really really bad food for us, wings or steaks or whatever, and watch adventurous movies like Indiana Jones or the Indiana Jones Chronicles, which it kind of cemented for the two of us the shared love of the period of the 20s and 30s. So we do have that kind of friendship developed from my childhood, at least, and bearing through these novels.
Well, I really love that. I'm very close to my father as well, and we work together as well, and so I know how that is. You were saying something earlier about, much to the dismay of your family, you kind of monopolize each other. I so hear that. Now tell me, I'm gonna switch gears on you a little bit and ask about the book. Tell me, the Gemini Agenda is out now as a third in the series. Tell us about that particular story. Can you give us a little bit of a synopsis?
Sure. It starts with essentially a murder mystery. There's a string of bodies discovered. They're drained of blood. Their eyeballs surgically extracted. So kind of a gruesome scene. And Winston Churchill has caught wind of the pattern through a source in Germany. He passes word on to William Randolph Hearst, the famous 1930s newspaper magnate, sort of like the 1930s version of Murdoch in a way. And Hearst puts his number one photojournalist, Maggie McGarry, our hero, on the case to look into this. Her lover, Bert Cochran, a former Army counterintelligence officer, but also a lawyer and writer, he gets pulled into the story somewhere down the road, and the payoff to all this is that the deaths are, I won't give away too much of the story, but it's tied in with the science of eugenics, and that's sort of the backdrop for the whole book. The science of eugenics back in the 20s and 30s was accepted science back then, that the way to get rid of genetic diseases and traits was to forcibly sterilize people that carried these traits. And this, you know, the United States actually sterilized, that, how much was it, like 70,000, 80,000 women against their will?
Well, throughout the 20th century, maybe as many as 60,000, but certainly by 1933, when Germany had yet to sterilize a single person, America had sterilized over 26,000. What happens in the story and why it's called the Gemini Agenda is that Maddie does solve, to some extent, the first 10 murders when she discovers they're all twins. All the victims are twins living in, you know, 10 separate areas. That leads to the discovery that there are 10 more missing twins, and that takes the story to Germany and the final answer of, you know, why are people doing this to twins?
And I love that. I love that, the whole mystery side of it. I mean, you have the suspense, you have the historical aspect of it, but this is very much action, adventure, mystery kind of a book.
Yeah.
Now, so tell me... a little bit of insight. Give us a little insight to the main characters that we find throughout the series.
Well, there are three main characters in addition to Winston Churchill. Churchill plays a role in all three of these books. Like Ken Follett used Churchill as a major character in The Man from St. Petersburg, his fourth thriller. Churchill was the catalyst. He got the story going, and he kept it going. He wasn't the protagonist, but he was the catalyst. Our protagonists, we wanted to have two, a man and a woman, and we wanted them to be naturally close to Churchill. Likewise, we wanted at least one American, if not more. And so we created Burke Cochran, Jr., who is the son of a real person, Burke Cochran, who was Winston Churchill's political mentor and role model. Churchill and Cochran met when Churchill was 20, and Cochran played a big influence in Churchill's life. Cochran himself, while he was married three times, his first two wives predeceased him, was childless. And we thought, well, let's give Burke a son, which will naturally make him close to Winston. And then Maddie McGarry is our other protagonist, and we portray her. She's Scottish, and she's Winston's goddaughter, and a, as Patrick said earlier, a top photojournalist for William Randolph Hearst. And they meet in the first book. Winston brings them together, and that's when their love affair starts, and it keeps going through all three books. So those are the two main characters, the two of them and Winston.
And well, I would add that they... Okay, go ahead. Sure.
Now, let me, and I want to go back for just a moment, Michael, and reading from the website, it says, Winston Churchill's Wilderness Years, 1929 to 1939. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, his wilderness years means he was out of power. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer for 5 years in the 1920s, and the Conservative Party lost the election in the spring of 1929, and Churchill was out of office. Even though the Conservatives came back to power within, say, 3 years, Winston was not given an office. He was on the outs with the Conservative Party because he was warning against the rise of Nazi Germany, and no one wanted to listen to him. And so the wilderness years are when Churchill was essentially a lone voice in the wilderness warning about what was coming down the road. Few people were saying what he was saying, and fewer people were listening.
So
during this period is when, and this is another reason it circles back to why Winston as a character. During the 1930s, when he was out of power, he had essentially a private intelligence network, both in England and in Europe, that were constantly feeding him information about German rearmament and what England wasn't doing. And in many respects, he was better informed than his own government about what was going on in Europe. And so we play upon his private intelligence network as a plot device as to how he hears all these things.
And I love, I mean, that just gives a whole other dimension to Churchill, I think. Now, you've written other books about Churchill. You're a contributing editor for a magazine on the editorial board of Finest Hour, the quarterly journal of the Churchill Center and Museum in London. You've written for the Wall Street Journal, Sacramento Bee, and in some other newspapers and magazines. Was writing this series kind of a natural progression of all that you love? Can you tell us a little bit more about your journey as a writer?
Well, I'm a lawyer by profession, but I've been writing since 1975. I am a contributing editor of the Libertarian magazine Reason for over 30 years, and I've been with Finest Hour for probably a good 15 years. I've written one biography of Churchill, the young Churchill, called Becoming Winston Churchill, The Untold Story of Young Winston and His American Mentor, which is about Churchill's relationship with Bert Cochran. I always have written about things that I enjoy, and turning to fiction seemed to be something new, and Patrick agreed to try it with me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you said it a little earlier about writing what you know. You definitely know a lot about Churchill, it seems. Now,
yeah, I do.
Yeah. Now, Patrick, I'm going to switch over to you for just a moment. You have kind of similar interests in news, it seems. You work for Fox Business Network. You've worked on ABC News 2020. You're an award-winning journalist, and you studied, and I find this very interesting, both 20th century European history and film studies at University of Rochester, which I think is a very interesting mix there. Tell me how you came to write fiction.
Well, I've always sort of been interested in fiction at a very young age, which is what got me interested in film studies. But film studies is not a terribly impressive major, so I started to get into history as well. And that's mostly what got me into my mix. And what made our partnership really conducive, given my own background in the history and the period and the general history of the time. So a lot of this comes naturally to me, even though my dad is the Churchill scholar. I have a good grounding in particularly German 20th century history. And so I have a lot of my own background to that. But I mean, how I came to write fiction, I've just been interested in writing stories for a long time, and then write my own stuff on the side. And I've been sort of into it ever since I was like in the eighth grade. It was the first time I really got into trying to write stories. And so film is just another way of doing that, and books are another way to get stories out there.
So tell me, what do you enjoy the most about these books? I mean, is it the craft? Is it the experience? You know, what makes you want to write an entire series?
Well, I don't think you can just write for the fan mail. That's very nice and lovely. It's lovely to get, but it takes a long time to get to the stage where you're getting fan mail. So if you don't actually enjoy the process of writing, if that's not the whole point really of doing it, then I don't think there's any real perfect point in writing books in the first place. I mean, if you can't please yourself in the process, then how can you please your own readers? So, I mean, honestly, the process itself, working with Dad, he'll have a germ of an idea, and I'll help him shape it, and we'll throw ideas back and forth, making it better, finding plot holes, problems that we have, inconsistencies, realizing what we're unsatisfied with, that this character doesn't develop enough, that how can we make that better? You know, that whole process is the whole reason I do it, and I think I've assumed Dad's the same way. But I think that's the bottom line. If you don't really enjoy the process and craft of putting it together, then there's no way your readers are going to enjoy either. So, yeah, I definitely have to say it's the craft.
Yeah, you know, and I hear this all the time, and I think that's what I hear you saying as well. You want to write the book that you would want to read. And,
yeah, exactly.
You know, and it sounds like the books, anybody who's a history buff would like these, but it appeals to people who like action-adventure as well and people who like mysteries. It's just got so many different aspects to it. It just sounds like it had to be just so much fun to come up with.
Yeah. And one of the things we borrowed, or at least tried to emulate from the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, the great lamented TV series that I grew up watching with Dad, is there something just tickling about having your standard to not, yeah, you know, having an adventure, having all the fun elements that go with the story like that, but then finding a way to place real historic characters, real historic events that actually happen that people recognize in the course of that adventure is just a neat little trick. It's really fun whenever, you know, at least I really enjoyed it in the Indiana Jones series, and we really try to recreate that kind of excitement in the books.
And you do a great job. You do a great job at that. So, now, Michael, how many books do you plan to write in this series?
Oh, we're not sure, but I have a germ of an idea as to the next three books. We're about a third of the way through the fourth book, where our heroes, Cochran and Maddie, foil a plot to assassinate Hitler in February 1933.
Interesting. Now, you know, we've been talking about the Gemini Agenda. You have two books that came before that. Can you just give our listeners a brief synopsis of those two? I just want to let them kind of get the flavor of these books.
The first two books, the first book in the series was The De Valera Deception, and it involved a conspiracy brought to Churchill's attention to foment a coup d'etat in the Irish Free State, and the action takes place in the United States during the summer of 1929 when Churchill is taking a three-month holiday through North America. And the Parsifal Pursuit involves a Parsifal-like quest for the Spear of Destiny, which is a real artifact, thought to be, but probably isn't, but thought to be the spear that pierced the side of Christ on the cross. And there actually is a Spear of Destiny in the Hofburg Museum in Vienna. I've seen it, and we posit a situation where the spear has been hidden away in the Austrian Alps, and Hitler wants it, The Kaiser looking to come back to power wants it, then Churchill wants it too. So those are the brief synopsis of the first two books. But essentially, throughout all three books, you have the romance of Burke and Maddie with its ups and downs. So that if you had to give a genre for the books, they're historical romantic thrillers.
And I'm glad that you brought that up because I did not spend a lot of time on that. I got caught up in the action adventure because that's the kind of reader I am. But I know that we have a lot of our listeners do like romance in their novels, and there definitely is some romance in this. I'm glad that you brought that up.
Well, we like as a writer Ken Follett, the early Ken Follett, his historical thrillers, and Ken Follett always has romance in his books, and we've tried to do the same thing.
And I'm a big Ken Follett fan. I guess anybody, for those of you out there who are Ken Follett fans, definitely give this series a try. You will not regret it. You're gonna love it. You're gonna love the series. Now, Michael, I know there's a lot of creative license going on in the stories. It is fiction, but other than the obvious fiction in the book, how historically accurate is it? With regard to the time period and historical figures, their personalities, etc.
Well, we make the background against which our fictional story takes place. We make that background as accurate as we can. Less in physical description because we don't do a lot of that. But the characters we put in, the actual historical characters whom we give speaking roles to, we accurately portray them. In the first book, we had Emma De Valera, Herbert Hoover, William Randolph Hearst actually is a continuing character in all three books because he's Maddie's boss. And actually, William Donovan, who was the first head of the OSS in World War II, was a Wall Street lawyer and a Medal of Honor winner in World War I, and so we have Cochrane working in Donovan's law firm, and so Donovan appears in all three books. Adolf Hitler appears in all three books. So we try and make it as historically accurate as possible, the background, so that while the stories are fanciful, the background and what is going on in the world is accurately portrayed. And we put at the back of each book a historical note, 4 or 5 mm-hmm. pages, because we like these in the books that we read to be told what's true and what's not. And we put a 4 or 5 page historical note at the back of each novel telling you what's accurate and what's not.
Right, and I love that. And, I know that, the three of us have had this conversation before. I think these books are great for book clubs. I love there's just so many different talking points for these books, and I love the bonus material that you have in the back. For those of our listeners who are out there and you're part of a book club, this is excellent material for striking up conversation and having discussions. So that's something to think about. So tell me, what's next for you, Michael?
Finishing the fourth book in the series. that's what I'm doing. But at the same time, I'm also thinking and talking about with Patrick the fifth book as well, because it's useful to know in writing a series where your characters are going next, because it helps. And so we have an idea of the outline of what's going to happen to our characters in the fifth book, which will take place later in 1933. The fourth book about the Hitler assassination takes place in 1 month, February 1933.
So tell me a little bit about what people are saying about the series. I'm sure you're getting feedback. I've seen some amazing quotes for the book. What seems to be standing out for people?
Patrick?
I'm not sure. I think I don't have them right in front of me, unfortunately, in terms of what they said if you grab the book.
Well, here, let me say this. I mean, people who like thrillers, people who like historical thrillers, like these books. I mean, they like the characters. They enjoy the period. I had one fan come up and tell me that he particularly liked the descriptions of New York or Chicago or San Francisco because he had been there. Walk down those streets, and he enjoys that part of it. People who like romantic thrillers like our books. That's basically what it comes down to.
Yeah, and there's, like, you know, and I said that earlier, it's like peeling an onion. There's just so many layers going on in the books, and, you know, people say, oh, there's something for everyone, and this truly is something for everyone. I mean, historical, there's some facts in there, there's the big what if, and the romance, and the mystery. So, you know, this truly is something that can get different kinds of readers hooked into the series. Well, I see that we're running out of time. And I want to thank you both for joining me on the show. Thank you, Michael and Patrick. Appreciate
you
coming.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Good time. Thank you.
And again, for our listeners, I just want to make sure I give you this website so you can go check it out. And I do encourage you to do that. There's some great material on the site, www.winstonchurchillthrillers.com. And, of course, you know, after the podcast, you can go over to readersentertainment.com, and we'll have some links up there where you can buy the books, a little bit of additional information. You can send your questions there and comments.